Welcome to Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise Magazine's Passion Series Interviews. My name is Janet Atwood, and I'm the cover editor for Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise and author of The Passion Test, The Effortless Path to Discovering Your Destiny. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, this series is an opportunity for you to learn what you need to do to discover your passions and live your personal destiny by hearing from people who have been incredibly successful at doing that in their own lives. There is a saying that well begun is half done. So tonight we must be half done in making 2006 an incredible year for all of us as we have two mega giants with us, my dear, great, great friend and co-host Mark Victor Hansen and our honored guest Dr. Wayne Dyer. Before I formally introduce both of them to you, let's talk about passion for a moment. This quote from the Passion Test encapsulates for me why passion is so deeply important for each of us. Passion is born of love. Love is the perfection of the divine in us. Love lives, breathes, and finds expression through us and fills us with the fire of passion. Fulfillment arises from love and through love. Let us live in love for love's sake. Let us be in love and share our love in the service of our common destiny. Let passion emerge from us as love in the service of humanity. We are so grateful that each of you is here tonight. You all have unique gifts which no one else can give. And by joining us on these calls, you join us in learning how each of us can share our gifts, live passionate lives, and make the world a better place in the process. Our guest tonight is a man who has done and continues to do a great deal to help make the world a better place. Dr. Wayne Dyer spent his early years living in foster homes and orphanages where he had to learn to be self-reliant. After serving 4 years in the Navy, he began his teaching career, receiving his doctorate in counseling psychology from the University of Michigan and Wayne State University. Today, he has published more than 10 best-selling books, starting with Your Erroneous Zones and continuing with such classics as Real Magic, Wisdom of the Ages, and his most recent, The Power of Intention. His newest book, Inspiration, Your Ultimate Calling, will be released by Hay House in March, when this interview will appear on the cover of Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise. So, Wayne, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's my honor. I appreciate it.
Oh, well, we are so excited. And I'm thrilled that tonight's interview with you will be conducted by another man who is having a massive impact on our world. My great friend, Mark Victor Hansen, is known to all of you as the co-creator of the phenomenally successful Chicken Soup for the Soul series, which has sold over 100 million books worldwide. And his most recent book, Cracking the Millionaire Code, teaches the principles of creating enlightened wealth, which not only benefits oneself, but one's family, community, and the world. Mark, it's a joy and an honor to have you as my co-host tonight, and I'll turn it over to you now to conduct our interview.
Well, I'm ecstatic. Thank you, Janet.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Hey, Wayne, what role has passion played in your whole life?
Oh, it is my life. I don't think there's any other word that could describe it. Passion is synonymous with enthusiasm, and most of you listening know that the word enthusiasm, from the Greek root, entheos, means God, and theosm means within. So the literal translation of enthusiasm or passion is the God within. And all of us, every single one listening on this line, and everyone that ever has showed up in the world of form, including all of the ancients and all of those who are to come from this place that quantum physics tells us is not particles. It's something beyond particles. You know, Jesus put it this way. He said it's the spirit that gives life. And all of us have come from this world, this invisible world of spirit or God or soul or consciousness or divine mind or whatever you want to call it. It is an invisible energy place, and it's what we all are. And each and every one of us out there listening, I always give the example of if you had an apple pie and you were to take a slice out of that apple pie and ask someone, what is that slice like? You'd say, well, it's very much, it's got to be just like what it came from. And if you took an ounce of blood out of your veins and it had a cholesterol level of 247, you'd probably suggest that the where it came from is also at 247 cholesterol, because you must be what you came from. You must be like the whole that you came from. And all of us, including myself, have come from this place called God, and it is that God within. in each and every one of us that that directs our lives, unless we leave it and take on something called the ego, which we're trying really hard to let go of.
All right, and now going way back in your history, tell us the story of how your first major book, Erroneous Zones, which is when I came into your life 31 years ago, came to be, and what passions played in making it and then delivering it to bestsellerdom.
Well, you were a young guy. I think you were in your teens or maybe your early 20s at that time.
Early 20s. Thank you, though.
Well, I wasn't much older than that, I don't think. I was teaching at St. John's University in New York.
Right. Now I used to carry in books for you at everywhere, including Carnegie Hall.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And you used to talk to me about what you were going to do and what visions that you had. And your goal at that time was to be around people who had those kind of images and visions. And somehow you connected yourself with me, and we've been friends ever since. And I'm just as proud of all the wonderful things that you have done as I could possibly be. Anyway, I wrote a book called Your Erroneous Zones. I took it to a publisher. The publisher finally decided to accept it. It was very interesting because the day that I was interviewing with the fellow, his name was Paul Farges, at the publishing house, it was Funk and Wagnalls at that time. When I walked into his office and I had my manuscript and I was there to really sell my manuscript, but Paul looked like he was very, very depressed and upset, and he had tears in his eyes, and it just looked like just like death warmed over. And I put my manuscript down and I said, "Paul, what's going on? Tell me." And I was 30, I think I was 30, well, it was 1975, so I was 35 years old. And Paul just sort of broke down and told me that the night before he had received some really bad news from his wife, who was asking for a divorce, and there was this long, involved discussion, and we talked for maybe 2 hours, and we never mentioned my book at all. And my agent, Artie Pine, called me the next day. He said, how'd the interview go? I said, "You know, Artie, I forgot to talk about the book." And he said, "What do you mean you forgot to talk about the book? How could that possibly be?" I said, "Well, he just seemed so upset, and I just was working with him and talking to him about how this could be a turning point in his life, and it didn't have to be a disaster, and what he could do with it, and he could turn it into an advantage, and all of these kinds of things, and that, you know, you are what you think about, and if you're thinking depressing thoughts, you're going to continue with the depression." And I said, when it was over, he was just uplifted. And well, the next day, Paul called Artie and told him that he said, "I don't care what the book is about." He said, I want that man with me on my, on our staff, and I would like to publish his book." And it always reminds me of the definition that Thoreau had when he was at Walden Pond back in the 1840s, and he was writing there about success in a in an essay called "On the Necessity of Civil Disobedience." And he defined success this way. He said, "If you advance confidently in the direction of your own dreams and endeavor to live the life which you have imagined, you will meet with a success unexpected in common hours." And it was like, that's what I was doing. I was just out there doing what I did. I was a therapist at that time and a professor, and it seemed to me that when I met a person who was struggling, it was more important to talk to him about that than to put my own wishes aside, and success chased after me. Well, after a few months, the book itself wasn't doing all that well. I mean, I was giving some lectures, and it was selling a few hundred here and a few hundred there, but basically they had figured it was on the list, and then when the next list came along in March, it would be over, and they'd move on, and they thought that would be, you know, considered a successful book if we sold a few thousand copies. Well, I decided that I wanted to do more with it than that, and I bought up the first printing, and then I bought up the second printing, and then I bought up the third printing, and I stored them in my garage, and I took them in a van, and I went all across the United States, and I began to deliver all of these books all over the country myself to the various bookstores, and making my own radio shows. There was a publicist in New York, her name was Donna Gould, and she became very much a big fan of mine, and she was very supportive of me, and I began to attract people who were really very helpful to me. And then one day somebody from The Tonight Show picked up, his name was Howard Papish, and he picked up a copy of the book, and he called me and he asked me if I would be willing to come out and do a pre-interview. This was after 8 months of traveling all over the country and delivering all of these books, some 7,000 of them myself. And I went out and I did a pre-interview, and they put me on the Tonight Show on a Monday night with Shecky Green, the comedian from Las Vegas. And I was interviewing, and it was August, I think it was the 24th of August, 1976, and it was the same day as the Republican National Convention, and Bob Dole, who ran for president at that time, was one of the leaders of the Senate, and he gave a talk that night, and he went over in the Tonight Show that I had just been been on had been preempted for the very first time in the history of The Tonight Show. And after I had done this great show, we had two wonderful segments. It turned out that it wasn't going to be airing. But it turns out, as it always does, that the next day Johnny Carson came in and he heard about the show that had been on the night before. And he said, well, if this new guy seems to be that good, he said, why don't we fly him back out here and do the show with him myself on Wednesday before that preempted show airs. So Johnny called me up, and I flew all the way back out to Washington, or out to Los Angeles, did the show, and then while we were on the show, he asked me if I would stay over and do it again on Friday because we didn't have enough time. And then on Monday, the preempted show aired. And after working and traveling all over the country and delivering the books myself and taking it all on myself, what Thoreau had promised all of us back in 1842 came true. He said, if you advance confidently in the direction of your own dreams and endeavor to live the life which you have imagined, you will meet with a success unexpected in common hours. It chased after me, and it's been chasing after me ever since. I've just been out there doing what seems to make the most amount of sense to me and letting go of the outcome.
Well, a lot of hundreds of listeners around the world, literally. I don't know if you were listening before it started with, we got India and Bangladesh,
yes,
and Europe and South America and Latin America. Hey, so a lot of those people are frustrated, downtrodden, beat up. How do you get over all that? And have you ever been there? Because a lot of them are there and wondering, you know, it's easy for Wayne Dyer or Mark Victor Hansen to say this, but can I pull that off?
Well, the truth is, Mark, you know, the real truth is I never have been there. Because, I've been in circumstances where I've had very little. I've had difficulties with addictions in my life. I have 8 children, so you can imagine that there's been lots of difficulties and struggles and joys and wonderful things that have happened. But I've never in my entire life, I've never even known what it was like to be unemployed, because I just have never believed in that. And I've always believed that I'm connected to something called abundance and prosperity, and that I'm entitled to it, and that it's something that that I think all the time. And I really believe that we become what we think about all day long. And I used to be known, Mark, as the richest kid in the orphanage. And the fact is that I remember finding out when I was about 4 that they used to have soda pop bottles, and then if you took them back, you got 2 cents for it. And when my eyes lit up when I found that out, I used to follow people around who were drinking a Coca-Cola and ask them, as soon as you're done with that, I'll take it off your hands. And I used to shovel people snow before they would even ask if I wanted it shoveled. And I would go down to the grocery store, and when ladies were taking their groceries out, I would just take the bags and take it and help them out with it. And, you know, it's now 2006, and I'm still collecting soda pop bottles and carrying out groceries. I'm just doing it on a larger scale. I've always believed and known that I was entitled to success and prosperity. It's something that I came into this world with, and it's why I think I've been able to write about it and live it, because I really don't identify with the idea that that the things outside of me, the environment that I'm living in, the condition of the economy, the person who happens to be in political power at this particular time, that any of those things have anything to do with what I can attract into my life. I literally know that whatever I put my attention on, and then I become a vibrational match, an energetic match to that. And I don't ever think in terms of it can't happen, it probably won't happen, it's not my luck. These are not the kinds of thoughts that I've ever entertained in my life. And when you met me, I mean, I was just a school teacher or a college professor back there on Long Island, and just out there, just beginning to do all of this. But I was having the time of my life, lecturing and talking and doing all of those kinds of things.
Pulling off lots of miracles. I mean,
yes.
I watched you go from nowhere to Carnegie Hall, if you don't mind my talking about it that way.
Right, I remember. That was true.
It was a joy for me to watch you, because you're the vanguard for a lot that I was going to pull off, and you've been a great help and inspiration to me, so I'm glad that's your next book. So what are the biggest challenges that have hit you along the way? And let me do the subset of that, because a lot of people out there would want to ask, how do they identify with success, abundance, prosperity, and all the good?
Well, it's the obstacles are. I don't ever call them that. I always think of everything that shows up as just an opportunity to transcend where I am at any particular moment. And I live in a universe that I believe Albert Einstein once said that the most important decision you'll ever make in your life is to decide whether you live in a friendly universe or a hostile universe. And I made the decision of my entire life, that I live in a friendly universe. And when you live, when you believe that you live in a friendly universe, then you're believing that the universe, or God, or soul, or spirit, or the source, or whatever you want to call it, is something that is going to support you, rather than something that's going to work against you. If you believe that you live in a hostile universe, then you'll have a lot of hostile thoughts, and you'll have a lot of beliefs that things aren't going to work out. You'll have a lot of inner knowings about your luck and how things haven't ever been that the way that you would like to have them be. You'll believe that there's no chance for you. I was sitting on an airplane not too long ago with and there was a woman sitting next to me who was a photographer. And we got to talking, and I said, "So you're a photographer?" I said, "Do you like what you're doing?" She said, "Yes." She said, "I really love it." I said, "Well, how do you do at it?" She said, "Well," and this was her exact answer. She said, "I'll never get rich at it." And I said, "Would you like to get rich?" And she said, "Well, who wouldn't? Of course," she said, "I would like to be able to have a lot of prosperity, and I'd like to have more money and all that." So here's a woman who has a desire to have prosperity and wealth show up in her life, and a belief system that she carries around with her. And a belief system, Mark, is nothing more than a thought that you've thought over and over and over again. That's what a belief is. It's just a repeated thought over and over and over. Like a habit is a repeated piece of behavior, a belief is just a repeated thought over and over. And her repeated thought that she has had, this was a woman in her 40s or so, she has believed for her entire adult life that she's never going to get rich at what it is that she is doing. And then she becomes a vibrational match to that, and she attracts that. And by the time the plane conversation was over, I had convinced her that she should be saying to herself that wealth is something that is on its way, and that if it's on its way, and I live in a friendly universe that supports me, then I am now always looking for everything that shows up in my life. I look upon it as an opportunity for me to reinforce the idea that it's on its way. And that includes all of the obstacles, that includes all of the things that we, quote, call struggles, because virtually all of the struggles and all of the difficulties that we have in our life are really things that are stepping stones to higher and higher and higher places. You know, in the Kabbalah, it teaches us that that in order for you to transcend a level in your life, it's usually almost always preceded by a fall. So that when I was in high school, I was the high jumper on the track team, and I used to run up to the bar, and in the process of running up to the bar to get over this high level, I would get down way low. I'd run up real fast and go way low, and in the process of getting down low, I would generate the energy to propel myself over the bar. And that's a metaphor for what I'm talking about. Every little obstacle, everything, every fall that you have, you know, is an opportunity to proceed. The addictions that I've overcome in my life, I look back upon all of them as wonderful blessings that showed up at particular times in my life that allowed me to reach a place where I understood that I came from a place of well-being and purity, and therefore I can get there. The times when I didn't have the kind of relationships that I wanted and so on, Nikos Kastanzakis, who wrote Zorba the Greek, once said that by passionately believing in what doesn't exist, we create it. And that which we call the non-existent has just not been sufficiently desired. So it's like I've always passionately believed in what didn't exist. With erroneous tones, I passionately believed and knew that it was going to be something that I was going to go out there and talk about and share and have the time of my life doing. And yes, there were lots of times when, I did this thing, by the way, with erroneous zones back when I was in my 30s with on a school teacher's salary. I had very little money. I used to figure out how to take a shower in a hotel without checking into it, by pulling up at a certain time and when the maids were cleaning and the door would be open, I would go in and shower, and I would sleep in the back seat of my car just in order to be able to pull it off. It's like when you have this vision that I'm speaking about and that you've written about, I mean, my goodness, I could be asking you the same question and you'd be giving me similar answers. When you have this kind of vision, and the vision is unshakable, I mean, it isn't like something that is determined on the basis of what shows up or doesn't show up. It's not determined on the basis of the economy. It's not determined by the basis of who I happen to have in my family, who I'm working with. This is like a universal, absolute knowing that what I desire is on its way because it's consistent with spiritual energy, and every thought that I have is going to be in harmony with that desire, so that I never would have a thought that I would like to be able to attract prosperity into my life and think about the lacks or the shortages in my life. Because if you think about shortages, you're going to attract more shortage. If you think about what's missing, you're going to attract more of what's missing in your life. If you think about what always has been, and you're always talking to everybody about what always has been, about what is missing or what you don't have, you shouldn't be surprised at all if that's what you continue to attract into your life. But if you put your thoughts on what's on its way, then you'll start looking for every little clue, and every person walking into your life becomes someone who is a messenger or a deliverer of something that is going to help you to deliver what it is that you have an intention about. That's a long answer, but and you want to know about passion? You just heard it. That's what I believe.
Yeah, by the way, that is profound, and that's what, you know, I trademarked a term called synchrodestiny, which says that each and every one of us is inculcated at DNA and RNA, our destiny, and if we allow it to unfold, that's exactly what happens, which is what you're saying, which goes to our next question. The power of intention. You talk about a universal field of intention responsible for everything in creation, and I hope we talk about David, our friend Dr. David Hawkins, a little bit on this. How does that all work?
Well, most people think of intention as something that I'm going to do, you know, that I'm going to make happen. And even based on what I've just been speaking about for the last few moments, you might even get that interpretation, that it's really a real hard kind of determination, and it's like it's something that I'm going to make happen, and it's like a pit bull attitude, and nothing can stop me, and whatever it is. That isn't how I wrote The Power of Intention, and that isn't what the PBS special is about, and that's not what how I look at intention at all, because that's ego, and that's, you know, you get to a place in your life ultimately. I'm now 65 years of age, and I know at this time in my life, I know that that God writes all the books and delivers all the speeches and builds all the bridges and literally creates everything, and there's a process in which we have to surrender to something. And as I said earlier, we all came from something, and we must be like what we came from. And our problems that we create for ourselves in our life is that we left this place that I call intention, which has these what I call the faces of intention, which are things like kindness and love and the idea that no one is left out, all inclusive. We all come from a place of well-being. We come from a place of endless abundance and love, and so on. So this is like if you had a pair of magical binoculars and you could put them on and you could turn them and focus them in such a way that they shone brightly on the source from which you came. Not your parents, not the particles, but where the original particle came from, in quantum physics, that place where where something magically all of a sudden happens, where we go from formless to form and life begins, right? The formless part. If we could focus on that, we would see that this field of energy excludes no one, okay? It excludes no one. It's non-exclusive. And every thought that you have that excludes anyone takes you away from your source. Every thought that you have that is not of love, that is not of beauty, that is not of abundance, that is not... Every thought that you have that is of shortage, every thought that you have that is of fear, that you have is of shame, all of these kinds of thoughts, every one of them, are thoughts that are out of vibrational harmony, or they're not in rapport with the field of intention from which you came. Now, if you want the power of intention, if you want the power of this field that you were intended from in the first place, if you really want that power, then you have to be like it, you have to think like it, and act like it. It's called thinking like God, which is what Einstein said. He said, all the rest is just details. I just want to know how God thinks. How does the source think? How does it create? And staying as... That's what I tried to do in The Power of Intention, is to teach people to be careful and cautious about every single thought that you have, because once you know that what you think about is what expands, then you start getting real, real careful about what you think about. You know, you get a little stiffle, and you don't expect it to get worse. You know, because if you do, then you're attracting that. If you I mean, I, Mark, you know, I mean, I think you can get a parking place with what I'm talking about. I mean, if you,
that's most, easy stuff.
Yeah, most people are looking for no place to park, and then they'll say there's just no place to park here. And of course, they're, you know, they get that tunnel vision, whereas the person that is focused on this the way I'm talking about, they see a parking place and everybody walking out of every building, and they're just anticipating and looking for it, and sure enough, there it'll be. It'll be there consistently. So, and yes, you're right. That is the easy stuff. Now, you mentioned David Hawkins, and in Power versus Force, which is one of the books that I've made a deliberate decision to get out of the self-published market, and Hay House has published it, and I've taken it myself to talks for the last 4 or 5 years, and sold several hundred thousand of them myself. And it's a book that it's called Power versus Force that teaches us. And I've written a little book called 10 Secrets for Success and Inner Peace. And the 10th secret is based upon my reading of Power versus Force. And that 10th secret says, wisdom is avoiding all thoughts which weaken you. So a thought of shame, for example, is a thought that's inconsistent with this field of intention from which you were intended. And you'll, if you do a muscle test on that, you can discover through kinesthesiology, you'll discover that you go weak when you think shame, and when you change the thought to one of love, you'll find that your muscles get strong. And
Wayne, just real quick, explain apply kinesiology. Most people online may not know.
Yeah, well, kinesthesiology is just nothing more than a muscle test, and a lot of chiropractors use it, and a lot of health practice. You know where I learned it? I learned it from my dentist years and years ago. He would be adjusting the occlusion on putting a crown in my mouth, and he'd have me get out of the chair. And I said, "What are you talking about? Get out of the chair?" He said, "Get out of the chair." And he said, "Now clench your teeth together and put your arm out and hold it as stiff as you can." And he would put his two fingers on my wrist, and he'd put his other hand on my shoulder, and he would push down. And if I was weak, if the occlusion wasn't adjusted, I would go weak, and then he'd get me back in the chair, and eventually I would be really strong. And every thought that we have, everything that we have, is affects literally all of the muscles of our body, and you can study it. In Power versus Force, he explains exactly how to go about doing this. If you have a thought, Mark, if you have a thought that is a lie, if I were to ask you to hold your arm out, and I put pressure on your arm, and I ask you, what is your name, and I ask you to lie to me and say, my name is Sam Jones, and if you were to look me right in the eye and say, my name is Sam Jones, and I'm telling you the truth, and I pushed your arm down, it would go weak. And then if I said to you, Mark, what is your real name, and if I ask you to tell the truth, and you said, my name is Mark Victor Hansen, I would push down, and what would happen? You would be strong. Now, the reason that this works, and I know a lot of people might have skepticism about it, but you can try it at home. I have a wonderful time with this because it's a great lie detector test. I always say we could have saved $93 million with President Clinton by just asking him one question, you know, and having him hold his arm out. Now, did you or did you not? You know, it was like anyway, I used to bring it. I'd bring it home and I'd do it with my kids, you know. And I remember my one daughter saying, you know, because I've got one daughter that everybody thinks is so goody two shoes and all of this. And I remember my daughter Serena saying, "Go, come on, ask her. Ask her, Miss Goody Two Shoes. Ask her if she ever smoked marijuana. Come on, go ask her." And she put her arm out, but you can do this with virtually anything, because what you're doing is you're using the body as an instrument, and the body was created by God. You didn't create this body. The body wasn't created by human beings. The body was created by the source, by God. And anything that is created by God, by source, when it's used and used as a testing mechanism, it always responds with strength to the truth. And now you take thoughts such as shame, thoughts such as fear, thoughts such as anxiety, stress, worry, hatred. All of these kinds of thoughts are thoughts that are not of God. They're not of your source. This isn't the field of energy. This isn't the field of intention from which you emanated. And when you have those kind of thoughts, they go weak. And when you shift them, and it's like, you know who taught us this was back in the 13th century was St. Francis, the man for whom then the city of San Francisco was named. Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me bring love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. In other words, let me bring a higher, faster, more spiritual energy to the presence of anything that is lower energy. And not only do you remove it, it's very much like like a dark room. Like if we're in a dark room, and darkness has a much lower energy than light. So if you're in a dark room and you're about to light a match, you don't have to say to the darkness, you know, you're going to have to get out of here. You're going to have to scurry now because I'm about to bring light into this room. When you bring light, just light a match in a dark room, not only do you nullify the darkness, but you convert it. And that's a brilliant kind of thing to think about. You convert it to light. Darkness becomes light. When you bring love to the presence of hatred, not only does the hatred dissolve and dissipate, but it is converted to love. And that's why it's so essential for all of us to reach these places of higher energy and continue to keep our thoughts consistent or in rapport with this field of energy that we all came from called intention. And when you do that, you regain the power of the source. And the power of the source is the power to manifest. It's the power to attract into your life what is missing. It's the power to heal yourself and others. It's the power to attract unlimited abundance and prosperity into your life. That's what it's really all about. It's reconnecting yourself to this field of intention. And I didn't invent this concept. This is an ancient concept that goes way back to Patanjali 2,500 years ago. He said, intention is not something you do. It is a field of energy from which all things are intended. Stay connected to it.
Yeah, and the beautiful thing about what our friend Dr. Hawkins is saying is that it's global and it's universal and it's not specific and it's not time-dated, so you can go backwards, forwards, it's irrelevant.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I'm just watching his videos and reading them, and I'm a relatively new student. I've been your student for 30 years. Next question. You got this great new book coming out in March, and we're going to do this interview, which is going to be published in Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise, and it's called Inspiration, Your Ultimate Calling. What's the premise of the new book?
Well, the premise of the new book is that there's a major, you know, lots of people have called me the father of motivation for all these years. I don't know, somebody laid that tag on me in an interview they did somewhere, and I've been called this. I said, I've got 8 kids. I don't need to be the father of anything else. I'm having enough trouble with that. But anyway, there's a major difference between motivation and inspiration, and this is really about living an inspired life. And I came across an observation of, I've been a student of Patanjali, who lived, he lived about 300 years before the birth of Christ. And he was considered to be like this divine, like spiritual man. He was teaching people about things like levitating and bilocation and some of the things that we think of as sort of New Age, weird kind of, things and so on. I mean, thousands of years ago when men were...
He did all of them?
Yeah, he was able to teach people through these various sutras how to literally leave your body and have it elevate. He taught the Japa meditation, the meditation that I've been teaching for years and years about using as a mantra the repetition of the sound of the name of God. And you know, it's like in the book of John, in the New Testament, it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And in the beginning of all creation, if you repeat this sound, the sound of the sound that's in the name of creation and so on. So anyway, Patanjali also talked about inspiration, and he had this observation. He said, when you're inspired by some great purpose, some extraordinary project, he said, all of your thoughts break their bonds. Your mind transcends limitations. Your consciousness expands in every direction. And you find yourself in a new and a great and a wonderful world. And then he said, dormant forces, that is, forces that you thought were dead and inaccessible, come alive. And you discover yourself to be a greater person by far than you ever dreamed yourself to be. So I took those 6 ideas out of Patanjali, created a new PBS special that's going to start airing March the 6th all across North America. And for those overseas, they can go on hayhouse.com and get the DVD of it. But it's a 2.5-hour...
Spell Hay House, because not everybody's got it.
Hay House, H-A-Y, from Louise Hay, H-A-Y-H-O-U-S-E.com.
Right.
And... So I have taken this idea of looking at now when we talk about motivation goes back to this concept that we have of intention. Motivation, a motivated person is generally thought of as someone who has goals and who has objectives and is trying to get someplace else and has sort of an inner vision of where they would like to be, and they work hard and they get up early and they leave a little bit late and they have all kinds of good work habits and so on, and they're said to be highly motivated. And that's not inspiration. That's motivation is you get a hold of an idea and you take it with you and you carry it through to its logical conclusion. That's a motivated person. Inspiration is the exact opposite. Inspiration is not where you get a hold of an idea and take it where you want it to go. It's where an idea gets a hold of you, and it takes you where you were intended to go in the first place. You know who Arthur, you remember Arthur Miller? He died about a year ago, the great playwright. You know, most of us had to read The Death of a Salesman or The Crucible. Well, he was 88 years old, and he was interviewed in the New York Times, and they asked him a question. Now, he had a play on Broadway at 88, and they asked him a question. They said, are you working on another play? And here was this man who was soon to be 90 who said, I don't know. He said, but I probably am. And I think it was one of the great inspirational moments in my life reading that, and it was really what one of the things that motivated me to write a book about inspiration from this perspective, that that there are things that get a hold of you. Now, Mozart was described this way, you know, that he would have what he called lively dreams, and he said that these symphonies would present themselves to him, and it was almost as if they were already written, and he would have to get them out and record them and so on. Now, you probably have experienced this. Most people, most creative people who've done a lot of particularly creative work understand this. Yep. Rumi, the great Persian poet, said, the morning breeze has secrets to tell you. Do not go back to sleep. Do not go back to sleep. And what he was saying there was that when you are closest to God, between 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, which is the best time for almost all of us, and almost everyone listening will awaken at one time or another between the hours of 3 and 4 and then go right back to sleep. But if you could understand that that's a wake-up call for you to be able to do what it is that you were designated to do, what you signed up to do, what your spirit is telling you to do, because inspiration is just about being in spirit. And when I get up when I'm writing, I get up between 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning, and I go out. I live on Maui, and I go out onto my writing space out there. And thank you, by the way, all of you, for my place on Maui. I really appreciate it. It's a wonderful place, and I appreciate you getting it for me. I mean that. I say that sort of, but I mean, I'm always in a state of gratitude for all of the people who have supported the work that I have done. And at any rate, so I go out there and I sit down, and there are times, I don't know if you've had this experience, Mark, but I sit down and I start writing. I write by hand. I don't write on a computer. And
I got a little typewriter.
And I don't even use a typewriter. I got rid of it about 20 years ago. That's right, I did, when we first met. I write everything by hand, everything. And I just allow it to flow through me. I allow it to flow through. I take a purple pen, which is the highest energy of the rainbow, and I allow this, I allow it to come through me. And there are times when I sit there at 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, and I allow this information to come through my heart and onto the page. And I sit there, and I wonder what's coming next. And I'll read it, I'll think, I didn't even know I knew that. And then if I get stuck on something or if I'm just not quite sure about something, I'll just reach over, and sure enough, there will be in a book that I've just grabbed off of the shelf or that's laying there. I'll just pick it up and open it up, and exactly what I needed will be in there. It's like when Patanjali said, dormant forces come alive, and you discover yourself to be a greater person by far than you ever dreamed yourself to be. What happens is that when you get yourself into that spirit and you allow it to flow through you and to work with you and to work for you and support you, it's taking you where you were destined to go. And when I sat down to write Inspiration, I mean, it was like I knew that it was something that I was going to write. And if you were to ask me the question right now, because I've just completed this book, it'll be out in another month or so. If you were to ask me, are you working on another book, I'd have to give you the same answer that Arthur Miller gave. I'm not sure, but I probably am. There's a lot of stuff that I'm thinking about. And it's like, it takes me, and then it starts showing up, and someone will mention something to me, and I'll take a note on it, and then I'll start keeping a file cabinet on it. I'm sure. You've got, how many books do you have now in the Chicken Soup? There's about 100, aren't there?
101 we just
got. 101. So these ideas
we don't own it.
Yeah, they must. That's right. They must come to you. You know, it's like you must just be there someplace, and all of a sudden say, "Wow, let's do one on chicken soup for I don't know, my hemorrhoids or whatever. I don't know what you're doing for."
How do you spell that guy's name, Patanjali?
Never mind. If you get that one now, I want at least a credit on it.
By the way, I don't plan on doing that, although it's probably a big market. We won't touch any market that sells less than $3.5 million, like Jigsaw the Golfer sold. And we won't touch medical doctors or lawyers. And the joke is lawyers don't have a soul, and I know you got great lawyers on the phone. Not joking, of course. How do you spell Patanjali?
Patanjali, P-A-T-A-N-J-A-L-I, Patanjali. Patanjali, some people pronounce
it. Patanjali. Okay, what's the relationship between passion and inspiration, seeing as we're doing this for...
Well, they're the same. They're the same. Inspiration means in spirit. Passion means the God within. So it's like it's just moving yourself back to spirit. And when you move into spirit, what you're really doing is you are... you're allowing yourself to think and act and behave like God. The way that I organize this PBS special, the television special, and the book is around this idea that there are certain benefits that come to you from living an inspired life. Your thoughts begin to break their bonds. In other words, you stop when you're inspired. That is, when you're in spirit, you don't know how to think in terms of limitations. You don't know how to think in terms of shortages. You stop thinking about what's missing in your life. It's not a possibility for you any longer. Your thoughts break their bonds. Your mind begins to transcend the limitations that you've had before in your life. And you stop seeing yourself. You stop seeing yourself as a human being. You begin to see yourself as a spiritual being, as a spirit, the spiritual essence of who you are. And you literally, Mark, you step outside of your body. And you begin to observe it, and you begin to laugh at all of the folly of it, and the foibles of it, and the worries that it has, and because you begin to see yourself as an infinite being, not restricted by your birth and by your death and by your height and by your weight and by your looks and all of those kind and all the things that you've achieved in your life and your acquisitions and all of that. You don't define yourself that way anymore. You let go of those what Patanjali called the false self, the illusionary self, the Maya. That's not who you are. Who you are is that from which you came. And as you get back into that place from which you came, you absolutely know that in harmony with God, all things are possible. I mean, it's right out of the scriptures. You know, with God, all things are possible. Now, I don't know how many people you got on the line, but let me ask every one of you. Now, what does that leave out? You know, it absolutely, literally leaves out nothing. There's no thing at all that is not possible. If you can conceive of it and have that knowing and stay in spirit and do it from that place of passion, that place, and passion is just love. I mean, God is love. I mean, that's also from the scriptures. God is love, and he that believeth in love believeth in me. I mean, love and God are synonymous. God and good are one. They're the same thing. There's no difference between the two of them.
Awful stuff. So, I think we've answered it, but why do you call inspiration your ultimate calling?
Well, because, I think that's a good question. That really is, because it is ultimately where you're headed. I mean, look around. I mean, where do you think you came from? You know, you start studying a little bit of quantum physics. If we were doing this interview here in the, about three centuries ago, we'd be studying Newtonian physics. And Newtonian physics was one in which we believed that, the building blocks of nature were these atoms. And that, that these were the tiniest particles in the universe and so on. Now with quantum physics, I mean, atoms are like huge buildings, compared to a subatomic particle like a quark. And then when you go to the ultimate, to the smallest, tiniest particles, and ultimately you break that one down in what they call particle accelerators, you open it up, you find out there's nothing there. That is just all energy. We came from this field of energy called spirit. And now we are here in this world, and we began. And for the first 9 months that you were here inside of your mother, you didn't worry about anything. Everything that you needed. I mean, one day you had a fingernail, the next day the fingernail was a little bit longer, then and then whatever it is that you needed, and you were just allowing. You were in a state of pure allowing. You were just and you would just grow, and you would be, everything would all be just fine, and then and you surrendered, completely surrendered to this spiritual energy that was allowing you to form into the perfect being that you are, the most beautiful perfect being that you could possibly be. Then you emerge into this world, and you get surrounded by people, and all of a sudden you start getting convinced that who you are is not this perfection from which you emanated, that it's going to take care of you, that it's going to provide for you, that's always going to be there, that's going to always work with you as long as you stay in harmony with it. You start believing that, hey, I am what I do. So now you got to do a whole lot of things, and then you get to a point in your life where you can't do them anymore, and now if you are what you do, and when you can't, then you aren't. You don't exist anymore. So then you start believing I am what I collect and what I have, and so you start collecting achievements, and you get a lot of trophies, and you believe that you are how much money you make, and then all of a sudden, that stuff starts to disappear, and you don't have it, and then you realize that your value goes out the window if you are what you have. When you don't have, then you aren't either. And so you take on all of these things, and this business that we're speaking about here is really just a business. We're just talking about enlightenment, about just reaching a higher and higher, higher level of consciousness. You know that while you're in this world of form, you step outside and you watch what's happening to your body. And you know, it's like I hold a hair up on the pillow and I say to my wife in the morning, what held it in yesterday? You know, it's like it's a complete and total mystery to all of us. We all know that while we're in this little parenthesis in eternity called our lifetime, that we're headed back to nowhere. We're heading back to, we go from what I said, nowhere, N-O-W-H-E-R-E. We show up in now here, which is exactly the same, N-O-W-H-E-R-E. It's just a little question of spacing from nowhere to now here. Now you're hitting now here. Everybody listening on the phones in this conference call is a now here.
In archived. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. And then, but you all know, if I ask anyone, you know you're headed back to nowhere. It's your ultimate calling. So in India, they try to teach you. My teacher, Nisargadatta Maharaj, was teaching us about how to die while you're alive. In other words, how to get to a place where you can let go of this body of yours and your attachment to it and all of your beliefs about what it is and who you are and all of that. Let go of all of that and die. But don't have to literally die and leave your body. You just get outside of it, and then you start living from this world of spirit, which is your ultimate calling. So your ultimate calling is to return back to the place that you're going anyway. And whether it happens now, I mean, I'm 65. It's hard for me to even say those words. I can't even believe it. I used to think 65 was just old. When I turned 64 last year, I got a birthday card. I was speaking in Durham, North Carolina. And my kids sent me a birthday card. It was really nice. I know, and it was. You remember the Beatles song, "Will You Still Want Me? Will You Still Love Me?"
Yeah.
When I'm 64. Well, I turned 64, and they sent me a copy of that recording. And then I opened up the card, and it said, "Inside of this card is a beautiful, perfect message from God." And I thought, you know what? I think I may have finally reached him. Isn't that nice? And I opened up the card. It said, "See you soon."
By the way, Art Linkletter and I have just finished a book called How to Make the Rest of Your Life the Best of Your Life. We're saying that 90 is a new 60 and 60 is a new 30.
Yeah.
Because as I look at you, you are, by the way, there are a lot of people that have probably not ever seen your physical form. And because I've seen Wayne go through lots of stuff, but the most important thing is that he is exceedingly fit. He eats extraordinarily well. Because we've shared meals, and I can see that his thinking is really clear, ladies.
I also do yoga. I don't know if you've done yoga at all.
I do yoga. I do my asanas regularly. I studied in India for a year. Oh, yes.
Did you? Yeah.
Yeah.
I do not know what you were talking about.
Oh, thank you.
But anyway, I do Bikram yoga. I don't know if you've ever done Bikram. It's hot yoga, you know.
Yeah. I've been to his house. He's had me as his house guest over there.
Is that right?
95 degrees, enough to melt your body down.
Yeah, 104. Try that. I do it I shouldn't say every day. I do it 5 days a week. And the yoga, I mean, it's one of those things I am totally sold on. You can't have arthritis if you do yoga, and you can't be depressed if you do yoga every day. My mom, who's going to be 90 on her next birthday, and it's really the picture of health, but she's been having this real problem with her back for 3 or 4 months, and I got so tired of her telling me every day how it hurt and this and that and almost crying because she was really in pain. And I got her a yoga video, and I just said, you've got to, you know, if you are living in a body that is sitting there watching television on a regular basis, and you're turning, you know, the years are going by, and you're now going to be 90 on April the 21st, I said, you've got to change. You know, Viktor Frankl once said in the concentration camp, if you can't change what's going on around you, outside of you, then you have to change yourself. You just have to change yourself. I said, Mother, you have to change yourself now. And you've got to, even if you just sit there in a chair and just reach up and do your stretches to the right and to the left and so on and get your mat out and all. She's been doing yoga. She's telling everybody about yoga. She quit, and her back pain is gone. And it's the first time in about 4 months that it's been gone.
So you got her a Bikram video?
I got her it wasn't a Bikram one because she can't do the heat, but I got her one that was on, it was on PBS, it's called Yoga for All of Us. But and she just puts it on every day and she does it, and she absolutely is just, you know, totally turned on by it completely, as I am. And it's not just that, I also walk every day and I swim every day. And, you know, I play tennis fairly frequently, and not as much as I used to.
I'm good at it.
Yeah, but it's just a way of life. It's just, it's about having, you know, if you don't, the Sufis used to say, if you don't have a temple in your heart, you'll never find your heart in a temple. And it's like treating your body like a temple, treating it like the perfect creation that it is. And every put down that you have of your body, every insult that you have, every belief that you have that it can't do something that it's not possible for it to do, that's almost like an insult to your spirit, an insult to your source, an insult to God, literally, because you are a perfect divine creation. And when it's used as a lie detector, it can never respond to anything that is not of truth with anything other than strength.
Amazingly good. Next question. In your book, you quote our friend, former UN Secretary Doug Hammarskjöld. In an era, the road to holiness necessarily passes through a world of action. What does that mean in the context of inspiration?
Well, it really means that ultimately what happens with this is that when you find yourself moving into spirit, you will begin to become a person who is a doer. Who can't just sit still and just watch. You don't become immobilized by the things that are going on in the world that you don't like. Like the number of people that are dying in these wars that are continuing around the planet, or the number of people who have AIDS, or the number of people who are victims of crime and all of these kind of things. You don't keep and continue to put your attention on the evils of the world. You begin to understand that for every act of evil in the world, there's a million acts of kindness, and you begin to shift that, and you understand this notion that you can't get sick enough to make another person better. If I thought that getting sick would help somebody else to get better, I would be encouraging people to go out and get sick. You can't get depressed enough to make one person undepressed. So that when you're around a depressed person and you find yourself getting depressed, you are just creating a new collective energy of depression. You can't get sad enough to make another person happy. You can't get depressed enough. You see, all of these kinds of things are really relevant and important in terms of being a person of action. If, you know, they said of Jesus that when he would walk into a village, just his presence in the village and nothing more would elevate the consciousness of those around him. So that when you reach a certain level of energy, and again, Hawkins speaks about this beautifully in Power versus Force and in The Eye of the Eye, this idea that if, as you begin to elevate your own personal energy, you begin to calibrate at a much higher and higher level, and you do this through meditation, you do this through staying in spirit, you do it through being on websites such as this, you do it through the music that you listen to, you do it through the people that you associate with, all of the kinds of things that are where you are attracting higher and higher and higher energy. As you get to that, then when you just your presence in around somebody else will elevate them. When Mother Teresa would walk into a room, everyone would feel better because she had pheromones of energy that would just, you just knew that, and you didn't even have to know she was there. You would just feel better just by being in the presence of someone like that. And again, I always remind people of what Jesus said, is that even the least among you can do all that I have done and even greater things. When you have Christ consciousness, or Buddha consciousness, or Krishna consciousness, or Muhammad consciousness, when you are living from these elevated places of love that are matched up with the field of inspiration and the field of intention, when you are matched up with that, you become a person of action. Your presence alone begins to change things. You know, a perfect example of that is Oprah Winfrey, you know, who has really worked very hard. I've known Oprah since she was 21 years old, when she was a talk show hostess over in Baltimore. And you know, she has gotten herself to a place now, or with her energy being so high, that just her presence going over to Africa and so on, she is beginning to make a huge impact on the and Bill Gates, who became the person of the year with his wife Melinda.
$29 billion. I cried when I read. For those of you listening, the Time magazine article had Melinda, Bill Gates, and Bono just trying to make the world work.
Yeah, but they've done it
in poverty. Sorry.
Yeah, and they've done it through elevating their own consciousness. This is something that you talk about passion. This is something that they're doing from passion. I just, I saw that, I read that, I was impacted by that and by Oprah and all of that. I just financed or funded a scholarship fund. I was admitted to Wayne State University in Detroit in 1962 after being 4 years in the Navy, and they admitted me on a provisional scholarship. I was on Guam, and I wrote to them, and they sent the application over, and then they sent the entrance exam over and all of this stuff, and I didn't have the high school grades. I hadn't even considered going to college when I was in high school, and they admitted me on a provisional basis. They allowed me to come in dependent upon how I did in the first year, and then I not only got my bachelor's and my master's and also my doctorate, and I became a professor at the university. I even had my own parking place, my own parking place at the university, which was the ultimate in prestige. At any rate, I've just funded a $1 million scholarship to have 50 students a year from the inner city of Detroit be admitted, those who are on provisional basis. In other words, and that comes from a passion, from a desire, from an internal knowing that giving back. You and I were talking before, earlier today, about our friend Ram Dass and helping to support him.
Back.
Yeah, and about giving back. This is a man who wrote Be Here Now and didn't ever take any royalties and didn't even take lecture fees. Did you know that? All through the 60s and 70s and 80s, when he was the most prominent lecturer on spirituality, he wasn't taking any lecture fees. He gave it all to the various foundations, the Seva Foundation. And
Seva alone saved 10,000 eyes of people, mostly in India and Bangladesh, that would be out of work because there's no Social Security.
Exactly.
I remember him telling me that one time.
Yeah, for $15 you could restore the sight of someone in Nepal and in India. And
what
so
I started with them was $5, so it is amazing what a good...
And if you'd like to, those of you listening, if you'd like to just go on my website, it's just drwaynedyer.com or waynedyer.com, you'll see a letter that I wrote encouraging people to support Ram Dass and help him, because he had a stroke in 1997, he's in a wheelchair, and we're helping him to get out of that wheelchair and helping him to become, get back on stage. I did a benefit for him, and Mark, you and Jack and people like yourselves have sent that letter out to people all over the world. I really appreciate that. And so does Ram Dass. In fact, he answers every letter, and we've raised about a third of the money that we need in order to provide him with a home. So that.
And for you listening, I know this was a bonus point to you, but if you go to Wayne's website, we will have set up, not tonight, but within next month, we'll have the date set up for Wayne and I and a few other celebrities are going to raise all the rest of the money for our friend.
Yeah, it's great.
It's just the right thing to do. Because
yeah, and that comes from passion, doesn't it? I mean, that comes from like a knowing that, how blessed we have how blessed we are and
want
to share it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Next question, sir. Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise just did an extensive survey of its readers. One of the questions was, what's your biggest challenge? 60% of the people, Wayne, said, I'm holding myself back. How do you get people advice so they don't hold themselves back and self-sabotage? You're the master of this.
Well, think about what those words mean, holding myself back. Now, how do you do that? I mean, I'm trying to get a picture of myself standing someplace and then getting a hold of myself and then holding myself back. I mean, there are a few yoga positions like that, I know, where you have to do the backward bend and things like that, but holding yourself back is almost like it's an unnatural thing to do. It's like, that slogan of, grab the bull by the horns. Well, anybody who grabs the bull by the horns is being stupid. You don't grab a bull by the horns unless you want to get killed. And you don't hold yourself back unless being back is where you want to be. And that, again, it comes down to a belief and a habit. What is a belief? It's a thought that you have thought over and over and over again. What is a habit? It's a behavior that you have repeated over and over and over again. Now, one of the most important things that you can learn is that you cannot find light by analyzing the darkness. And you cannot find moving ahead and moving forward by hanging on to what you used to be. It's called, I call it in 10 Secrets for Success and Inner Peace, I call it giving up your personal history. And if there's any advice that I could be giving you right now, it would be giving up your personal history. In other words, take a look at, and I learned this from Carlos Castaneda, one of the great teachers, I think, of our time. And, he used to talk about a boat and standing on the stern of a boat that's heading up the river at 40 knots. I mean, it's moving pretty fast, and you're standing at the stern, and you're looking down at the water, and what do you see? What you see is called the wake. You know, it's the wake. And what is a wake? By definition, it's a trail that is left behind. It's just a trail that's left behind. So you ask your question, first of all, what is the wake? Well, it's a trail that's left behind. What's driving the boat? You know, the boat becomes the metaphor for your life. Well, what's driving the boat is the present moment energy that's being generated by the engine. That's the only thing that makes the boat go forward. And that's the same thing that's making your life go in the direction that it's going. Whatever present moment energy you are applying to what you are doing. But the most important question to ask yourself in this little scene right now with you standing on the stern is it possible for the wake to drive the boat? That is, can a trail that is left behind make the boat go forward? And the answer to that is obviously it's not. But you live in that illusion when you're holding yourself back. That's the illusion that you're living in, the belief that what you have been up until now is the reason why you can't continue to go forward. But that's just as faulty a system of logic as saying, well, the thing that's making the boat go forward is the wake. The trail that is left behind is just that. It's a trail that is left behind. It's back there. You don't want to continue to hang on to that. What you want to hang on to is whatever energy it takes to no longer be connected to your personal history. And as Castaneda often said, if you don't have a story, you don't have to live up to it. So get rid of your story and don't be back there where you used to be. Instead, get a hold of this present moment energy and begin to have a passionate love affair with what doesn't exist, living from the end, treating yourself as if you already are what you'd like to become, treating yourself that way. When I sit down to write a book, when I wrote this book, Inspiration, which I just am so in love with, I wrote the words Inspiration on a book cover, and I wrapped it around another book that I had written, and I set it right there on the table. And truly, Mark, every day when I would sit down to write, at starting around 3:15, 3:30 in the morning, after meditations in the morning, I would see this book finished. I was acting as if it was already completed. It was just a matter now of just my filling in the blanks, that's all. It's something that was already done. And it's, you begin to understand within yourself that it's in the contemplation of an idea that you would like to create, it's in the contemplation of it that you attract it and that you create it.
Every morning at 4 o'clock, he got up and said, God, all these people are, the boll weevil's eating all the cotton, what do we do? And he got crop rotation, he started growing legumes, so nitrogen went back in the soil, and he got all the black farmers to do it, and they came and said, Dr. Cobb, you got us all these peanuts, there ain't no buyers. And so he meditated on it, and he got Say's Law, which says an entrepreneur takes something low value to a high value. And he created 367 products for peanuts at 4 a.m. in the morning. So you're right on. You're on the cosmic time.
Yes. Well, they say, Thomas Tryon used to say that the law of flotation was not discovered by the contemplation of the sinking of things. And it's true. And it's true. Even, I mean, we get on airplanes now and we fly all over the world, right? And, we think about the Wright brothers just 100 years ago. That's all it was. I mean, it's
very short.
And, they didn't go down to Kitty Hawk thinking that this thing isn't going to get off the ground. So the law of flying was not discovered by the contemplation of the staying on the ground of things. You know, you need people who are contemplating what it is that they absolutely intend to manifest, and through the process, nothing more. There's no greater secret that I can offer everybody listening here. It is in the contemplation of what it is that you intend to manifest that will give you the power to manifest it. You've got to be able to contemplate it, to be able to rush it through your mind and see it over and over again. And it's that process that gives you the energy. Not only does it give you the energy to allow it to come forth, but dormant, as Patanjali said, dormant forces come alive. That is, forces that you thought were dead, and you mentioned synchrodestiny. You know, Carl Jung coined the term synchronicity, and that is just like where you have a all of a sudden you have a collaboration with fate. And you start seeing, as you elevate your consciousness, you'll start finding yourself thinking about someone, and they'll call you on the telephone. You'll start thinking about an idea, and somebody will mention it to you, and then somebody else over here will mention it to you. Then you'll turn on the TV, and it'll be mentioned over here, and you'll see these alignments, because spirit speaks to us, not in messages on our computer. It speaks to us in alignments, in alignments. And as these alignments begin to take place, these forces start to work with you, and now you're in a friendly universe that is cooperating and working with you rather than the one who works against you. And I can tell you, all I can tell you for sure is that I know is that it works, because it's always worked for me.
Perfect. Last question, and then we're going to give it back to Janet to close with both of us, Wayne.
Okay.
Like you, Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise believe strongly in the power of intention to manifest outcomes. What's your biggest current project, and what intention would you like us, along with the readers and the listeners, to hold for you, Wayne Dyer?
Well, I met a woman in New York. Her name is Immaculee Ilibagiza, and she's written a book that's called Left to Tell. Back in 1994, in April, a genocide began in Rwanda that lasted for 91 days. And this woman hid in a bathroom for 91 days and survived just through the power of faith, her power of knowing, her power of God. And I have written the foreword to her book. It's called Left to Tell, and it's the most inspiring, dramatic, powerful book that I've ever been privileged to be a part of. She's on the new PBS special, which will be airing March the 6th all over the country. Her book comes out next month, and all of the people in the back of my book on inspiration, or if you go to hayhouseagain.com and ask, you know, for a $5 contribution, they'll send you a purple bracelet, and we're using all of that money to help all of the orphans, because I don't know if you know this or not, Mark, but in 1994, in a country the size of the state of Maryland, with 10 million people in it, 1 million people were slaughtered in 91 days. 1 million people were slaughtered with machetes. And when you contrast that to 9/11, which was 3,000 people, which was horrible in itself, but 1 million people. And it's like there are so many orphans and people over there with no arms and no legs and so on. So that's my project. I'd like everybody listening to, in February when the book comes out, to read Left to Tell. I don't think you'll ever... I think she's a saint walking among us. She's one of the most beautiful, divine, spiritual people. You might want to put her on your show sometime. She's just absolutely an astonishing, astonishing woman.
Janet?
Yeah, Wayne, would you give us that name again?
Well, it's a pretty tough one for most people to know because, you know, most people aren't familiar with those names. But her name is Immaculee Ilibagiza. But the name of it is Left to Tell. That's the name of the book. And it'll be out next month. It's published by Hay House. And if you go on my website, you'll see a picture of it. And I also wrote the foreword to it. And she'll be touring with me and speaking. But we intend to take over to Rwanda in April, several million dollars from people who are buying these bracelets. It's really just a marvelous, wonderful cause. And,
oh, well, we'd like to help you with that, so we can talk more after.
Okay, that's great.
Thank you so much.
Thank
Mark,
you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mark.
I love doing it. Wayne and I have been, as he said, great buds for a long time.
Long time.
Just so great to have
you. Even had hair when I met you. I'm the one that had hair. One of us
had hair. We both had hair.
That's right.
Okay, I'm the one that had the most hair. So now, for our listeners, if you want to know what Mark is up to, be sure to go to www.markvictorhansen.com, markvictorhansen, HANSEN.com. And Wayne, what a remarkable soul you are. I'll tell you, you just were walking the talk that I just so love to listen to. Thank you so much for being with us tonight, and I'm sure everyone would agree. You know, I don't know if I mentioned it earlier when we spoke, but I just flew home last night from India, and I've spent the past year interviewing saints throughout India and Nepal, and it's just such a treat to come back home and experience another saint here in my own homeland, actually two of you.
Oh, well, that's so kind.
No,
I'm blessed
to hear that. It's just so wonderful, and you've connected us tonight with the deepest part of our own spirit and created the inspiration, which is the subject of your new book, so again... Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I've always, I always enjoy doing these kind of things, and because I'm big, as Mark is a fan of mine, I'm a big fan of his as well. I treasure all of his great success, all of those wonderful, wonderful books on that he has produced.
And we treasure all these people that are going to have infinitely more success out in front of us, Wayne, because
absolutely.
Of, you know.
Yeah, from all over the planet.
To be by
yeah.
changing their consciousness tonight. We did it.
Yeah,
great.
Both of you did. So thank you so much. It was really such a wonderful flow of knowledge from both of you. So thank you again.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Before I tell our listeners about our upcoming interviews, I'd like to close with this quote from Inspiration, Your Ultimate Calling. Taking action is how we increase our connectedness to spirit. If we're heeding our ultimate calling, we must be willing to act on that mission. We may believe that inspiration is something that arrives in some mysterious way that's beyond our control, or perhaps we're waiting for God to send us motivational signs. But it's clearly best to rely exclusively on our decisions to act in ways that will intensify our awareness of spirit. So great, wonderful quote. For our listeners, you can check out Dr. Dyer's latest products and projects and receive more of his inspiration by going to www.drwaynedyer.com. That's www.drwayne, D as in Dorothy, Y-E-R.com. And remember, Dr. Dyer's new book will be available in March from Hay House. As always, we have some extraordinary interviews coming up for you. On January 24th, we interview Dr. Ivan Meisner, one of the world's leading experts in networking and word-of-mouth marketing. Dr. Meisner is the founder of BNI Business Networks International, the world's largest referral organization with over 80,000 members and more than 4,000 chapters around the world. On February 7th, we interview award-winning speaker Les Brown. And on February 21st, the co-author of The Chicken Soup for the Women's Soul and Mother's Soul books, Jennifer Hawthorne, will be our guest. So be sure to join us in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, remember, your passions are your clues to your unique destiny. Choose in favor of your passions every day, and you will find yourself living a passionate, turned-on life. Now we'll open up the lines and say goodnight. Mark and Wayne, incredible, incredible gift from God this night. Thank you so much. Good night, everyone.